So I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have. So I'm going to ask Clay to go ahead and turn on his video source. And we're going to turn the floor over to Clay Nelson, who'll be serving as the primary presenter today. So Clay, I'm going to go ahead and spotlight the video on you. And then I'll go ahead and ask you to pull up the slides. And once we confirm that your slides are up, you can take it away.
All right. Thanks, Jean.
Yes. Slides look great. Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, welcome everybody to session four, the last of our four-part training series on assessment of relative bioavailability of soil arsenic and lead in human health risk assessment. The first half of today's session will focus on laboratory methods to measure relative bioavailability and in vitro bioaccessibility, followed by the first of two Q&A sessions. In the second part of today's talk, we will discuss soil sampling, handling, and processing best practices to obtain analytical data on total soil metal concentration, IVBA, and additional analyses should they be warranted. For more information about topics discussed in today's training session, you can email the Technical Review Workgroup Bioavailability Committee at bahelp@epa.gov. You can also email the BAC co-chairs directly at the emails listed here. And we encourage you to browse the BAC website, which can be accessed through the link shown here. Let's start with a quick recap of key topics discussed in training sessions one, two, and three. First, bioavailability in today's context is generally defined as the fraction of total soil arsenic or lead that, upon ingestion, is absorbed across the gut wall and available for distribution in the body, where relative bioavailability is defined as the ratio of the absolute bioavailability of lead or arsenic in soil to that of the same contaminant in the standard used to develop the toxicity value for that contaminant. We are interested in assessing relative bioavailability because total concentrations of arsenic or lead in soil may not provide an accurate measure of risk. Rather, it is the bioavailable fraction that poses risk to human health. Therefore, including RBA data in human health risk assessments can improve the overall accuracy of the assessment, often with the added benefit of cost savings when inclusion of RBA data enables a reduction in the scope of cleanup or other remediation-based action needed at a site. RBA can be directly measured using in vivo animal models, commonly juvenile swine or more recently, mice. However, to reduce needs for in vivo testing, increase sample throughput, and reduce costs, EPA has validated an in vitro bioaccessibility method, or IVBA for short, that uses a simple chemical extractant designed to mimic human gastric conditions, which has been shown to be a reliable predictor of RBA, known as EPA Method 1340, a topic that we will discuss in more detail today. Session two began by discussing conceptual site models as a useful tool to identify relationships between contaminant sources and receptors, taking into account things like chemical fate and transport, source and receiving media, and how these models can be used to inform development or refinement of data quality objectives, including RBA data needs. We next discussed different ways RBA data can be applied at arsenic or lead contaminated sites, including RBA adjustment of a soil exposure point concentration, for lead, adjustment of bioavailability parameters in risk models, notably the integrated exposure uptake biokinetic model or the adult lead methodology. For arsenic, adjustment of a soil contaminant daily oral intake value, and finally, adjustment of risk-based screening or action levels. These approaches are discussed in more detail in Section 5 of EPA's 2021 guidance document for IVBA sample collection. We ended Session 2 by discussing systematic planning for development of data quality objectives when RBA data is used in risk assessment of soil arsenic or lead contaminated sites, consistent with EPA's 2006 report entitled Guidance on Systematic Planning Using the Data Quality Objectives Process. We reviewed the seven-step DQO development process with relevant examples provided for each step. These included: 1, state the problem. For example, the problem is a concern of unacceptable human health risk from exposure to lead-contaminated soil via the incidental soil ingestion pathway. 2, identify study goals. For example, to determine if the mean RBA-adjusted soil lead concentration exceeds a target risk level. 3, identify information inputs. For example, measurement of total soil lead concentration and in vitro bioaccessibility, which we use to estimate RBA. 4, define the boundaries in both space and time of the study. For example, identifying how a site will be divided into multiple decision or exposure units. 5, develop the analytical approaches that will be used to measure totals in IVBA. 6, specify the performance criteria. For example, defining our false compliance and false exceedance decision error probability goals. And finally, 7, develop a detailed plan for obtaining data. In session 3, we discussed recommended performance criteria to inform sample planning, including developing data quality objectives related to the probability of making a false compliance or false exceedance decision error. As a reminder, we generally define false compliance decision errors as occurring when the decision or exposure unit being assessed is contaminated at levels that exceed the action or cleanup level, but sampling leads to making the incorrect assessment that contamination levels are below the action level. Similarly, we define false exceedance decision errors as occurring when the decision or exposure unit is not contaminated at levels in excess of target risk levels, but sampling leads to making the incorrect assessment that it is. Next, we discussed two sources of error or uncertainty that may contribute to making a false compliance or false exceedance decision error. Estimates of mean or quantile contamination levels are only as accurate as the samples used to derive those estimates. We refer to this as sample representativeness. In general, as we increase the number of samples collected from a decision or exposure unit, whether that is by increasing the number of samples analyzed, or for composite sampling, increasing the number of sample increments per composite, our confidence that the samples are representative of average conditions increases. Finally, we ended session 3 with a live demo of the Bioavailability Sample Planning and Evaluation Tool, a new tool developed by EPA's Bioavailability Committee to assist risk assessors and risk managers with estimating false compliance and false exceedance decision error based on the sampling plan being considered, along with key assumptions required to estimate decision error probability. The tool can also be used to support evaluation of data adequacy after samples have been collected and data generated. These include developing estimates of decision accuracy post-sampling, i.e., an estimate of our confidence that we are making the correct assessment. For example, that the exposure point concentration falls above or below an action or cleanup level, along with estimates of decision precision, where precision is defined as the probability that resampling using the same sampling plan would result in the same assessment of the EPC relative to the action level. As a reminder, the long-term plan as to how and where the tool will be hosted is still being finalized. So for now, please email the BAC committee for more information about the tool. Let's proceed with today's training session, where we will start by discussing laboratory methods to measure RBA and IVBA, and end with a discussion of soil sampling, handling, and processing best practices. Various animal models have been used to directly measure relative bioavailability of arsenic or lead in soil. These include monkeys, juvenile swine, and more recently, mice. These in vivo assays rely on measurements of blood, tissue, or urine as metrics of the fraction of ingested arsenic or lead that is absorbed across the gut wall and available for systemic distribution throughout the body. We define relative bioavailability in today's context as the absolute bioavailability of arsenic or lead in soil to that in the standard used to develop the toxicity value for that contaminant. For lead and arsenic, the media used to derive toxicity values is typically water. As a reminder, RBA can and often does vary from soil to soil or area to area based on a variety of factors, including soil geochemistry and contaminant source. Recently, EPA scientists have developed a more cost-effective and higher-throughput mouse model to directly measure soil arsenic and lead RBA in vivo. Soil arsenic and lead RBA measurements in mice have been shown to be comparable to those in juvenile swine, and the mouse model has been shown to provide highly reproducible estimates of RBA. For more information on in vivo models, you may refer to the peer-reviewed studies shown here. And importantly, the cost to derive in vivo RBA measurements using the mouse assay is approximately 90 to 95% less than using swine or monkey assays. As an alternative to reliance on in vivo assays to directly measure RBA, scientists have developed in vitro assays that measure the bioaccessibility of arsenic or lead in soil. Where bioaccessibility is generally defined in today's context as the fraction of arsenic or lead in soil that is extracted in the solvent designed to mimic key aspects of the human gastrointestinal system. Multiple assays have been developed and published in the peer-reviewed literature that vary with respect to the degree of physiological representativeness in humans. For example, some IVBA assays include only a stomach phase, while others may include one or more additional phases, including, for example, intestinal and saliva phases. EPA has a specific process for validating IVBA assays for regulatory use that considers, among other factors, agreement of IVBA data with RBA measurements across multiple soils that vary with respect to soil geochemical properties, contaminant sources, and level of contamination. EPA has validated a specific IVBA assay that conveniently has been shown to be a reliable predictor of both soil arsenic and lead RBA. Briefly, this assay uses 1 gram of soil added to 100 milliliters of a 0.4 molar glycine solution, acidified to a pH of 1.5. The soil solution is extracted for 1 hour at 37 degrees C, i.e., human body temperature, to mimic gastric conditions of the human stomach. The solution is then filtered and analyzed for arsenic or lead using an appropriate analytical method, for example, by ICP-OES or ICP mass spec. It is important to clarify that 1. Method 1340 has only been validated for use in soils and not for other media such as dust or other contaminants beyond arsenic and lead. And 2, other IVBA assays in the peer-reviewed literature have not been validated by the US EPA for use in human health risk assessments of arsenic or lead contaminated soils. One important clarification. If you simply Google EPA Method 1340, you may find a version that discusses lead only, not arsenic. If you instead search specifically for EPA's 2017 Standard Operating Procedure for an in vitro bioaccessibility assay for lead and arsenic in soil, you will find the updated method version that includes arsenic in addition to lead. You can also find this SOP linked in the BAC website referenced at the beginning and end of today's talk. I wanted to take a moment to provide this clarity, as a question asked in a previous training session suggested not all participants may be aware that EPA Method 1340 has now been validated for both arsenic and lead. This slide shows the linear regression equation used to convert measurements of soil lead IVBA to estimates of RBA when expressed as both percent and fraction values. The figure below shows the soils used to derive or fit the linear regression equation as part of the IVBA validation process. Similarly, this slide shows the linear regression equation used to convert measurements of soil arsenic IVBA to estimates of RBA, again when expressed as both percent and fraction values. And the figure below shows the soils used to derive the validated linear regression equation. As specified in EPA Method 1340, there are upper limits to the total soil lead or arsenic concentration where the soil to solution ratio of 1 gram of soil and 100 milliliters of extraction solution is appropriate. For soils with total arsenic or lead concentrations that exceed these values, saturation of the extraction solution becomes a concern, which may lead to underestimating soil metal RBA. For situations where IVBA measurements in these highly contaminated soils is of interest, one solution may be to modify the soil to solution ratio to avoid concerns with solution saturation. However, it is advisable to consult with the EPA BAC in these situations. Considering the high level of contamination in these soils, however, risk assessors and managers may also want to consider, on a case-by-case basis, the likelihood that using RBA data to adjust total metal concentrations or risk-based action or cleanup levels in these highly contaminated soils would even lead to meaningfully different remediation or risk management decisions to assess whether measurement of IVBA data would be time and money well spent for these soils. In addition to concentration-based limitations on use of Method 1340 to measure IVBA, there are concerns with accuracy of the assay when used for soils with high levels of phosphate to measure lead IVBA, typically phosphate levels that exceed 5 grams per kilogram soil. If high phosphate levels are suspected in soils, phosphate levels should be measured. Naturally occurring levels of soil phosphate are not expected to interfere with Method 1340, and most general use fertilizers contain little phosphate. This interference is typically only a concern for soils that have been amended with phosphate as a remediative strategy to reduce lead bioavailability in situ. As previously noted, IVBA assays have been developed to reduce reliance on animal testing, increase sample throughput, and reduce data collection costs, with the goal that IVBA testing can and should be used to estimate RBA for use in human health risk assessments, as opposed to directly measuring RBA using an in vivo model. However, animal models are still important research and development tools for a number of purposes. These include 1, improving IVBA assay predictions, should that be needed, 2, identifying factors including soil geochemistry, contaminant source type, and metal speciation that contribute to variability in RBA, 3, develop new or evaluate existing soil metal remediation strategies, primarily those involving in situ amendment of soils to reduce metal bioavailability. And finally, 4, to develop new RBA prediction methods for other soil contaminants of concern beyond lead and arsenic. In vivo animal assays may also be warranted when evaluating soil types not represented in data used to validate the IVBA assay. These include, for example, soils treated with amending agents to alter mobility or bioavailability of arsenic or lead in soil, or soils or contaminant sources deemed unusual. Acknowledging that the term unusual is a qualitative descriptor subject to personal interpretation, if you are concerned that the soil geochemistry or contaminant source is in fact unusual, consultation with the EPA BAC is recommended, as it is my understanding that there is not currently a comprehensive list or reference of what should or should not be considered unusual. This completes the first half of today's training session. I will now hand it back over to Jean to lead us into our first of two Q&A sessions.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to ask my fellow panelists to go ahead and turn those camera sources on. And as I start adding our panelists to the spotlight, let me just gently remind for the live audience, you can send in your questions or comments to our team using that Q&A window. Now, if you have no additional questions or comments at this time, you can certainly send that in as a message so that we know that we're spending a suitable amount of time here and we can move on if there aren't any questions. But if you do have questions, this is the time to type them into the Q&A. So again, I'll encourage you, if you have not done so, either send me a message and let me know that you don't have any questions at this time, or if you're in the midst of typing them in, I am doing my very best here to buy you a little bit of time to finish that message so that you can submit it into the Q&A window, and we'll pause to take questions with our panelists. So I'm seeing a couple of messages coming in here from the attendees that they don't have any questions at this time, but I do want to just hold tight here for just a few more seconds, just to make sure that for any attendees who might have been doing their due diligence to type out a really well-worded, properly punctuated, highly referenced question, that they have time to get that in and we can go ahead and address it. Clay, one of the other questions that I have received in some of the past sessions that we've done, and we'll just remind people if they weren't here on at the beginning, is will the all of these webinars, will they be available for people to access after the session to watch on demand?
They will be, and I provided a link for that at the end of the talk today, and I believe in the emails that all the registrants receive that link is included there as well. But Jean, you can confirm or deny that that is
Yeah,
included.
you got it. You are exactly right. So all of the sessions will be available. And in fact, we'll send a follow-up email that has links to all four parts in one email. And we'll have a flyer that we'll be able to distribute so you can access any of these sessions on demand.
And you can even just do the audio portion. So next time you go on a walk, you can listen to some exciting EPA training.
That's right, Clay. We're available in the iTunes podcast store. If you didn't know, you can take us on the go. So thank you for that plug. But I do see a question that came in. One of the participants wanted to know, is method 1340 applicable to sediment materials?
And this is that I can start, and folks can weigh in if I forget anything. But the method is for direct exposure to humans, and it's for incidental ingestion. So if you have a scenario where there might be incidental ingestion of sediments, then I think that's appropriate. As far as kind of analytical concerns about looking at bioavailability in sediments, I think we don't have any concerns about the method working there. We would sieve to a different size, and there have been a few sites that did it in sort of sediments, where people are swimming and are wading, playing in that kind of thing. So I don't know if other panelists have an opinion there, but.
Okay. Matt, I think you got that one. Thank you. All right, excellent. Our next question, this is in regards to the different types of soils evaluated for the methodology. Was the material such as slag or fill high in lead, was that evaluated, or were you just looking at, quote, regular soil?
Karen or Gary or Matt, do you want to take that one?
Sure, I can answer that one. So specifically for lead, we did have a number of a few slag materials. I don't know specifically about fill materials, but we did have some elevated concentrations for lead as well as arsenic. So we know that we also included arsenic slag as our one of our test materials, if not a few of them.
Right, excellent. And I am seeing some requests in the queue for the recordings. So I promise if you put a link, if we're asking for those recordings, I will get you those links directly. We did have just a clarification, Karen, on that last question. They noted that for arsenic, it would be fly ash. So did you look at fly ash?
We have not looked at fly ash specifically for arsenic to validate this method.
Okay. And we did have a few people bring up new EPA guidance. And one of the attendees was curious if you anticipated that IVBA was going to be used more frequently now that the lead RSL has decreased.
I can probably jump in on that because I also I co-chaired the lead TRW for the agency. It is still highly recommended and strongly suggested in the new lead guidance that bioavailability be assessed as part of risk assessment.
All right, fantastic. Okay, I don't see any additional questions in the queue at this time. So I think perhaps just in the interest of time, what we'll do is we'll carry on with the presentation, but I'm going to let the audience know we are going to stop again later on for another Q&A break. So please keep those questions coming on in. Clay and team, you've done a fantastic job. I think we've gotten through everybody. So I'll go ahead and turn the floor back to you, Clay, and let you carry on with the presentation.
Okay, great. So as promised, the second half of today's training session will focus on best practices related to soil sampling handling and processing to support high-quality data analyses. To start, we want to quickly highlight two useful resources to support sampling design and collection. The first is EPA's 2002 report entitled Guidance on Choosing a Sampling Design for Environmental Data Collection. Note that this document does not discuss sample design specific to IVBA analysis, but the guidance discussed in the report is generally applicable to sample design for collection of a variety of data, including IVBA. EPA's 2021 report on guidance for sample collection for in vitro bioaccessibility assay, a document that has been referenced frequently throughout all four training sessions, does specifically address recommended best practices for sample collection specific to measurement of in vitro bioaccessibility. Generally speaking, there are two approaches to selection of samples for IVBA testing. The first approach is to collect and process samples for subsequent analysis, but begin by first measuring samples for total metal concentration. TOTAL's data can then be used to support selection of a subset of samples for IVBA analysis, possibly enabling selection of samples relevant to decision-making. The second approach is to analyze samples for TOTALs and IVBA concurrently, in other words, without prior knowledge of the sample's total metal concentration. This may be preferred to speed up overall data generation necessary to complete the risk assessment. Regardless of the approach used, incorporating RBA data needs into the DQO process prior to sampling is advised, as it makes the field collection effort more efficient, it simplifies the data collection process, and provides important clarity on how data will be used. In addition to analyzing samples for total metal concentration using laboratory-based analytical methods, screening samples in the field for total arsenic and lead concentration via portable XRF may be worth considering. Benefits include possible reduction in the unnecessary collection of samples that do not meet established criteria for IVBA analysis, reducing the likelihood that additional field deployments are needed, and reducing waste generation. If considering field use of XRF for this purpose, useful resources include 1. Method 6200, part of US EPA's SW 846 compendium of over 200 analytical methods, and 2. EPA's Superfund X-ray Fluorescence Field Operations Guide. One thing to note with respect to use of XRF relevant to today's training, if soils contain lead to arsenic ratios in excess of 10 to 1, this may interfere with XRF measurements of soil arsenic, leading to erroneous non-detect or less than detection limit values. When collecting samples, the depth at which the sample is collected is critically important to accurately estimate risk for a given exposure pathway. For most scenarios involving exposure to contaminated surface soil, including where incidental soil ingestion is an exposure pathway of concern, EPA recommends a sample depth of the top 0 to 1 inches of soil below organic litter and sod. At this shallow sampling depth, obtaining sufficient sample mass may require collecting a larger soil mass than is typical, especially if the material is particularly coarse, or for discrete sampling, where total sample mass is the product of a single sample, as opposed to multiple sample increments to generate a composite. Sampling at other depths may be needed if other exposure scenarios beyond incidental ingestion of surface soils is a concern. With respect to sample mass required for analytical analyses, for totals, Chapter 3 of SW 846 recommends a minimum of 200 grams of bulk soil be collected and 2 grams of sample that has been appropriately processed be used for totals analysis. As a reminder, in the context of today's training session, when incidental soil ingestion is the exposure pathway of concern, that means sieving bulk soil to less than 150 micron particle size, the particle size that has been determined to best represent exposure risk from soil ingestion, for analysis of both totals and IVBA. It is often preferable that bulk soil be coarse sieved in the field prior to shipping to analytical labs for subsequent analyses to remove larger debris. A combination of a number 4 and 10 sieve size works well for coarse sieving in the field. For IVBA, Method 1340 specifies 1 gram of processed soil be used per sample replicate for analysis. And again, soil should ultimately be sieved to less than 150 micron particle size prior to running the IVBA assay. Wrapping up this slide, it is always advisable to discuss sample mass needs with the analytical lab or labs that will be performing analyses prior to the field collection effort, including QC requirements that may necessitate collection of additional soil mass. Continuing with the discussion of sample mass, keep in mind that minimum mass of bulk or coarse sieved sample required for analytical analyses will vary, at least in part, on the soil's particle size distribution and moisture content. So, to the extent possible, consider these factors when determining the appropriate sample mass to be collected and shipped to labs. And to continue with a theme that is always recommended to consult with labs when determining sufficient sample mass, if samples are to be submitted for in vivo bioavailability studies or speciation analysis, consult with a lab that will be performing these analyses prior to field collection. You may also want to contact the BAC committee as well, as they are here to assist you. A few things to consider with incremental composite sampling design. In garden areas, exposure pathways of concern may differ from those in other areas of a site or property. If that is the case, it is generally recommended that soil samples from these garden areas not be composited with samples collected elsewhere. Similarly, with respect to lead specifically, you may want to not combine or composite soil samples from house drip lines with other areas, as lead within the drip line may include lead paint, which may warrant special assessment consideration. This should be determined on a case-by-case basis. With respect to sample containers, again, not to sound like a broken record, but it is always wise to consult with the analytical lab or program that will be conducting analyses about appropriate sample container type and size requirements. In general, appropriate sample containers include glass jars, wide-mouth HDPE bottles, plastic zippered bags, or similar container that is clean and free of contaminants of concern, in today's case, being lead and arsenic specifically. There are no specific sample storage container requirements for IVBA analyses specified in EPA Method 1340 beyond general recommendations already discussed. In general, a single 1 gallon plastic zippered bag or 1 liter HDPE bottle should provide sufficient sample material for at least the metals analysis an IVBA assay for most soils. Though a 2-gallon bag, larger HDPE bottle, or multiple bottles may be needed, for sandy soils or soils that contain rocks or other coarse material, or have not been coarse sieved in the field. Note that there may be cost savings with using plastic zippered bags compared to HDPE bottles, both in terms of container and shipping costs. But again, consult with the analytical lab performing analyses before selecting the appropriate sample storage container. With respect to selecting the most appropriate soil sampling equipment, a key consideration will be the depth at which samples are to be collected. Where dermal contact and incidental soil ingestion is the exposure pathway of concern, samples should be collected from the top 1 inch of soil. Stainless steel cylindrical punches enable capturing a constant diameter sample core, and kick-style punches may reduce sampling time. However, these may not be the best choices for sandy soils, soils with heavy clay content, or rocky soils. Plastic or stainless steel spades, trowels, or spoons are other options, but the trade-off with these sampling devices is that the sampler needs to take extra care to ensure that the samples are collected evenly across the sampling depth, and if collecting sample increments to composite, that sample mass is reasonably consistent across increments. For exposure pathways that warrant deeper sampling depths, augers, split spoon samplers, or even large equipment like backhoes may be necessary. If sampling at depth, care should be taken to account for any soil compaction that may occur from sampling. And any equipment that is reused to cross samples should be thoroughly decontaminated between samples to prevent cross-contamination and maintain sample representativeness. When in the field, samplers should take thorough field notes and document and retain any photographs, logbooks, and notes. Notes should include mention of any differences observed in media between sample locations, along with noting any potential interferences that may be suspected, such as presence of amended soils, to the extent such information is known or suspected. This next set of slides will discuss sample processing that is typically performed by the analytical lab performing analyses, as opposed to in the field. Upon receipt of samples by the lab, samples should be dried in an air drying oven at temperatures below 40 degrees C for up to 5 days or until a constant sample mass is achieved. Any observable soil clumps can be gently broken up using a clean, gloved hand to assist with the sample drying process and prepare samples for sieving and homogenization. Samples received from the field should not be ground by ball mill, mortar and pestle, or any other grinding method, as doing so may result in a reduction in soil particle size, leading to a possible artificial increase in IVBA measurements and therefore estimates of RBA, as soil particle size is one factor known to influence RBA of arsenic and lead in soil. Instead, samples should be sieved. For samples that were not coarse sieved in the field, it is recommended to first sieve samples using a number 3.5 or 4 sieve placed on top of a number 10 sieve to remove pebbles, conglomerated soils, or any other coarse material. As is the case with any sample handling or processing of contaminated soils, PPE should be worn when processing soils, and any processing should ideally be performed inside a dust containment system, such as a vent hood, to reduce possible exposure to contaminated soils. Sieves used should not be made of brass or contain lead solder, as these can contaminate samples. Prior to analysis, samples should be sieved to the particle size representative of the exposure scenario of concern. Again, for incidental soil ingestion, this means fine sieving the samples down to a less than 150 micron particle size fraction, the particle size range that has been shown to be representative of that which adheres to children's hands. In this example, a number 100 sieve should be used with a receiver pan placed below. For coarse sieved samples where clogging of a number 100 sieve is a concern, intermediate sieve sizes can be used as needed. To maximize data representativeness, analytical analyses intended to represent the same exposure scenario for the same contaminant should generally be conducted on the same dried, sieved, and homogenized samples to the extent possible. To split samples into equivalent aliquots for different analyses, processed soil can be passed through a riffle splitter, and aliquots collected in clean 250 ml HDPE bottles or similar appropriate storage containers. Keep in mind that homogenized samples for lead and arsenic analyses prepared as described today may not be suitable for an analysis of other contaminants of concern or other exposure scenarios beyond incidental soil ingestion via hand-to-mouth activity. Processed soil should be stored in clean, toxic element-free storage containers and labeled with date, soil ID, soil particle size range, and personnel initials, along with any other information deemed relevant. Sample weights should also be recorded, typically to the nearest 100th gram. Sample identification, documentation, and chain of custody should follow requirements of the analytical lab or program that will be conducting analyses. For arsenic and lead analyses, samples may be shipped and stored at ambient temperature unless otherwise specified by the analytical lab or program. EPA recommends a holding time of less than 6 months for metals analyses. Note that this holding time is a general recommendation in accordance with SW 846 and is not based on behavior specific to the IVBA assay. If there is a need to analyze samples beyond the 6 month holding time, consider consulting with the BAC to determine if analysis of these soils is still appropriate and what impacts, if any, longer sample hold times may have on data. After analyses have been completed, EPA Method 1340 recommends samples be archived should further analyses be needed. With respect to QC samples, Method 1340 does not specify or require field blanks, replicates, or matrix spikes be prepared in the field. Rather, these samples can usually be prepared as needed by the analytical lab using soil from the same sample aliquot. However, the importance of consulting with the analytical lab performing analyses prior to field collection cannot be overstated. This will help ensure sufficient sample mass is collected in the field and identify what sample processing procedures need to be performed prior to shipping samples to the lab. When working with potentially hazardous materials, health and safety procedures should be adhered to, including, but not necessarily limited to, those of the US EPA, OSHA, any health and safety procedures required by contractors, and all site-specific health and safety plans. As noted in previous training sessions, speciation analyses of contaminated soil may help explain variability in IVBA or RBA across geographical scales, for example, across the site or across decision or exposure units, identify contamination sources, and or assess mobility of arsenic or lead in soil. Consultation with the BAC is recommended if speciation analyses are to be performed. Be aware that shipping and handling of soils collected from many parts of the U.S. are regulated under the United States Department of Agriculture's Plant Protection and Quarantine Program, as part of their mission to safeguard crops and forests from entry, establishment, and spread of economically and environmentally significant pests. The map shown here dated February of 2024, shows counties within the U.S. where transport of soils to laboratories receiving domestic origin soil samples is regulated under the PPQ program. Note that this information may change with time, and the map shown here may not be comprehensive of all areas where soils may be regulated by the USDA or other agencies. So please consult with the USDA PPQ prior to collecting and shipping soil samples. And with that, I would like to finish where we began at the beginning of training session one, with this cartoon that reminds us why EPA has taken the time to provide training on assessment of relative bioavailability of soil arsenic and lead in human health risk assessment. Not all concentrations and forms of lead and arsenic in soil are equivalent with respect to human health risk. Rather, risk will be more accurately assessed after adjusting total soil metal concentrations for the fraction that is bioavailable, thereby increasing our accuracy in human health risk assessments and, in many cases, reducing the scope and associated costs of remediative actions that may be required at an arsenic or lead contaminated site. And like last time, I will briefly pause to allow you to read the cartoon. As a reminder, for more information about topics discussed in any of the four training sessions, you can email the Technical Review Workgroup Bioavailability Committee at bahelp@epa.gov. You can also email the BAC co-chairs directly at the emails listed here, and again, we encourage you to browse the BAC website, which can be accessed through the link shown here. This completes the four-part training series on assessment of relative bioavailability of soil arsenic and lead in human health risk assessment. A special thank you to those of you who have participated in all four of the training sessions, to the EPA BAC committee for organizing these sessions, and to Jean, manager of EPA's Cleanup Information Network website and moderator of these training sessions, for her expertise in moderating these sessions. For those of you who were not able to attend any of the previous training sessions, all sessions are archived and can be viewed at the link shown here. And now, I'll turn it back over to Jean for the last time to lead us into our second and final Q&A session.
All right. Thank you so much, Clay. So again, I'll ask my panelists to come on camera, and I will continue to encourage the audience to go ahead and send in your questions into that Q&A window. If you have no further questions, that's also a perfectly useful response. So you can send in a message either way. Type in your questions. Let me know you have none. I will give everyone a hint. There are a number of questions that are currently in the queue, so we are going to stop here and take several of those questions. I'm still popping up some more video sources here, just making sure I've got all of my panelists on. I'll find you all if I haven't. There we go. All right. So I think I've got you all up there on the side, and I'm going to start with this very first question that came in earlier about XRF measurements. So I think, Charlie, this one might go to you, asking if XRF measurements can be used as real data in risk assessments on a Superfund site.
Yeah, no, I'll ask Sydney to join okay. in. She's also RPM on the site where we've used historically XRF for the vast majority of our data. It can, you know, but with everything, there's qualifiers. You have to have appropriate quality assurance, quality control. If you set up your XRF in Sydney's FOG guidelines from Region 4, really has good methods how to set up your QA, QC to get defensible data. Yeah, you can. Like I said, I have a Superfund site where, you know, the vast majority for the first 4 years was XRF. It was a laboratory-based XRF that we set up. We ran our own lab. We set up our own sieves, our own shakers, our own dryers, and we did XRF there. It was just, you know, right next to the site. So really, you know, as long as you have the appropriate QA/QC, and we still ran approximately 5 to 10% through traditional wet chemistry. Sydney.
Yeah, no, Charlie covered it. I think Gene is also going to drop the link to the Region 4 Field Operations Guide for XRF that Charlie was talking about. But as long as you follow those steps and you establish a correlation of when you're seeing XRF versus labs. So when we established this in the beginning, we're sending all of the samples that we're XRFing to the lab until we make sure that it's appropriately used, because there are cases where if it's extremely high in arsenic, then sometimes it can skew the lead. A lot of times they're co-located, so it doesn't really matter anyways, or you know, but to be used in risk assessment, you can. There are steps that you need to take to qualify that to make sure that it is, you know, quote unquote defensible data.
All right, excellent. Thank you. All right, Karen, I think this next question is for you. One of the attendees asked, does method 1340 include the less than 150 millimeter sieving requirements mentioned, or is this an extra step that we need to discuss with the lab?
That's a great question. Method 1340 does include the sieving step to less than 150 micron sieve size fraction and gives general directions on how to do that. So that's included with the methodology.
All right, fantastic. And then I
Cool.
think,
Jean,
sure.
I would add, some labs like to sieve, some labs refuse to sieve. So again, like everything else, you need to check with your lab to see if they have capability. And some labs, you know, like on my big sites, you know, I would overwhelm their capacity. So it's just another one of those checks that you need to do when you're getting ready to send things to the labs.
Sure. Matt, did you have anything to add?
Nope, that was it.
Nope. Okay. Beautiful. Thank you. All right. And again, I think this question, I'm going to start with you, Chris, pardon me, Karen, but please, by all means, field it off to some of our other panelists. And this is regarding the use of plastic bags. Are plastic zippered bags acceptable soil containers for a Superfund site? The EPA's CLP samplers guide generally requires the use of glass or plastic bottles or vials.
Another great question. We've used plastic bags many of times for our Superfund sites for people to send those to us in the Office of Research and Development for in vivo as well as in vitro bioaccessibility testing. I'll actually ask Charlie, maybe you could chime in about your experience using plastic bags.
The vast majority of my soil samples I send in plastic bags, with the caveat that we make sure that the plastic bags aren't contributing to any contamination. You know, we will either analyze them with XRF, or you know, we'll put in some clean sand, you know, and shake it around, then analyze that sand, make sure it's not contributing anything. But yeah, the major problem I have with, you know, the plastic bags is, you know, I usually have to double bag them, because if you don't have the zipper top, sometimes they pop open during shipping, or you know, I'll tape them. But again, this you need to check with your lab, make sure that they're okay. But yeah, I've sent tens of thousands of samples via plastic bags. Sydney probably has as well.
Yeah, and when you're using the XRF, you're shooting with plastic bags. So a lot of time that can also help if you're doing like a correlation to where you've checked the plastic bag to make sure there's not interference with the XRF. You've analyzed that soil using XRF, and then you're sending that same sample to the lab. I mean, it's just going to help expedite, and everything can move smoothly, even though it's just in plastic. I've never had a problem with it. Even when we did the urban background study, we were using Worldpacks and sending those off to the lab. So,
Yeah,
okay.
and of the probably thousands of plastic bags that I've shot, only have run across some that had high levels, and maybe once or twice. And you know, we just changed manu or went to a different brand, and you know, then you know, we found you know that they were good after that. So.
Yeah, I've honestly found with the XRF, the cheaper the bag, the better, which is kind of nice, because if you use like freezer bags or stuff like that, they're just like so thick, they will cause an interference. But in terms of just like a general bag, like we used to just go to the local like dollar store and just stock up on all those, and it was perfect.
Okay. All right, our next question. I think what we're going to do is this may go to Charlie, you, and maybe Sydney. It's getting into the depths of sampling. The participant notes that this may not exactly pertain to IVBA sampling, but they wondered if you could give an example of when sampling beyond 1 inch would be advisable. What is a typical exposure pathway for soils at depths greater than 1 inch?
Yes. You know, I'm a human health risk assessor in Region 8, and we almost always sample at depth, especially in our residential scenarios. So, you know, a common exposure scenario in a residential yard is that if you have a pet, if you have a dog, they'll dig a hole, you know, lay in it, roll around, and, you know, that hole can go down to, you know, 4 to 6 inches, you know, just depending on the dog. So, you know, that's a significant source of, you know, track in is, you know, the dirt coming in off the dog. And then also, you know, you have kids, you know, kids like to dig holes. So you have, you know, kids in the background, in the backyard playing, you know, they go deeper than that 1 inch. And then for, you know, even the deeper, we usually go down to 18 inches for the most part in our residential scenarios. You know, you have the homeowner who's either doing some maintenance on, you know, a sewer line, sprinkler line, something like that, or planting a tree. So you want to know, you know, exactly what the exposure potential is for that resident at a deeper site or at deeper depths. Sydney?
Wasn't letting me unmute, but yeah, no, Charlie covered it. I mean, it's really, I would think it's more of like a residential and a park scenario where kids are digging or dogs are digging, and that's where you're going to get a little deeper into it. I mean, normally with commercial properties, you're not doing all too much besides just that general inhalation exposure.
Right. Fantastic. Okay. I am going to just get into a few additional questions that are coming in here. One of the participants wondered, are there situations, for example, such as certain contaminants of concerns or sources of the COCs, property uses, et cetera, that would warrant sieving the soil samples to something less than 150 micrometer particle size? If so, could you clarify or provide examples? So this is a sieving question. If we need time, we can come back to it.
I was going to point at Matt.
Yeah, go ahead, Charlie.
No, I was going to Matt.
and I was going to point to the risk assessors, but I think this is not specific to the method. This is a general assessment of what sticks to fingers, to human fingers, and gets incidentally ingested. It used to be 250 micron. We bumped it down to 150 micron. So that's for what's a general recommendation. You know, we do it for lead, recommend it for arsenic, and for wetter soils, we would do 250, but it's incidental adjustment is the reason for that.
Yeah, and that did come out of the lead TRW. So the recent scientific evidence demonstrates that the sub 150 micron soil size is the fraction that most adheres to a child's hands or to a person's hands. So that's the reason why we made that shift from 250 to 150. And so it was just based upon compelling scientific evidence. And so the lead TRW had made the recommendation that for human health risk assessment, everything be sieved to sub 150. And I believe the bioavailability just, you know, kind of also latched on as well due to the evidence.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go through a couple of specific questions about the method, and then we're seeing a common thread come out about a practical implementation. So I'm going to let those questions continue to queue, but there seems to be one popular question that several people are asking about in actually taking this to practice. Getting back to some of the specifics about the method, are IVBA samples and test results considered invalid or biased if they were provided without DQOs for the purpose of developing cleanup standards? meaning that such a situation would warrant starting over to put together DQOs and then recollect your soil samples based on these DQOs.
We'll start on this one. I don't think it'll make it invalid and biased. It does depend on how your samples were collected. I think that we like to generally have a range. So we will choose low, medium, and high values to see how the bioaccessibility is correlating and relating with all of that. And then also, if you're only taking them from one source and you later figure out that there's multiple sources of contamination at the site, you're going to need to go back and recollect. I don't know, Charlie, I might kick this one to you also.
Yeah, and Ghassan, I didn't mean to ignore you. I know you have a lot of regional experience if you wanted to jump in.
Yeah. So, you know, we prefer to use a data quality objective every time we would like to address, you know, evaluation of the bioavailability specifically to the total samples that is collected. So the total concentration usually you would require a complete data quality objective, and within that, it will cover also whatever quality objective you're having for your bioavailability samples.
Yeah, I would kind of agree with Ghassan. You know, usually I like to have, you know, defined DQOs and QAQC. And if that, in a case like that, was one of my sites, I would probably use it for screening value to help inform developing a sampling protocol. You know, it all depends if it's a if you have a litigious PRP, you know, it may not pass muster. But, you know, I would probably strongly suggest to the RPM to maybe start out small, go back and collect some additional samples under defined DQOs, see if it confirms what the original data set showed. And go from there. You know, if you get conflicting evidence, then you have to, you know, develop a much larger sampling protocol. But I would tend to use it more as a screening level.
Okay.
And as a non-EPA person with no authority to say anything policy related, I would just add that what I'm hearing is there may be some case-by-case considerations. And I think that's a great reason to reach out to the BAC committee, especially for samples specific to measurement of IVBA, so they can look at your specific situation.
All right. Excellent. All right, let's take a quick look at, looking at the method itself. Incremental sampling typically includes grinding of soils by the lab for totals analysis. The participant then asked, should this soil sampling analysis method be avoided for IVBA if grinding is not recommended?
Well, I'll take a whack at that. And you can absolutely do ISM and run the method 1340 on it. Do not grind, but sieving to 150 will have the same impact. You grind to increase the homogeneity of your sample, and sieving will have a similar impact. But with ISM, you know, you're going to run triplicates for field reps and triplicates for lab reps. Those are going to tell you what you need to know and if you're hitting with DQOs or not. But sieving to 150 and then following the rest of the ISM protocols, you should easily meet your DQOs. I don't know, Charlie or Ghassan or Sydney, if you guys have used those.
Yeah, I would. And the reason why we don't grind is because it's really creating an artificial, for human health exposure risk assessment, is that it's really creating an artificial exposure scenario. You're creating a smaller particle size, and it's not what the, you know, person would be exposed to. You know, here in the region, a lot of our naturally occurring arsenic, tends to be rinded in quartz, so that really the arsenic, there's only a small fraction of it, of the arsenic particle that is exposed. But when you grind it and you're removing kind of that rind from around the arsenic, now you're creating something that really the person would not be exposed to. So it's increasing the amount of arsenic that is in the sample. So yeah, we use incremental sampling on the vast majority of our sites. We just don't grind.
Okay.
We also, prefer not to grind the samples. There is also idea that if it is already weathered, sampled, or the sol or total sol or bulk sol is a newly developed soil, and if you are looking for the future and what's the potential of that soil or a large container that need to be grinded to check what would be the future, potential future of that concentration if we know that it would be weathering. So we prefer that we, when we sample, not to grind and try to, and that's why, if it is weathered already, you already go, taking the sample that would be most concerned about, which is less than 150 microns. So we look at both whether it is weathered or not weathered too. I mean,
Okay.
if it is a newly developed mine or something like that, then you would look at that. But usually we don't grind.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take our next question about background samples. When is it important to collect IVBA in background samples?
Well, I guess that's in my wheelhouse. That is very much a site by site question. IVBA would not necessarily be useful for background the way our policy, our guidance recommends doing it. But one way it could be used is to confirm that, where you selected the sample for background is unrelated to the site. This assumes that there's some uniqueness to the bioavailability of your site versus what's kind of ambiently available. So not every site is going to be that different from background in terms of IVBA, whether it be useful, but we have hard time differentiating locations as to is this contaminated by our site or background, and it's one tool you could consider. But I don't know that it's necessary or recommended there, just a possible tool in the toolkit.
Okay. All right. How about ecological risk assessments? Could you use data from this method for ecological risk assessments?
I
Charlie,
know
I
it's
see you
a
smiling.
topic you can ask regional folks.
Matt, you're the eco guy.
Yeah, I sit in the world in between. I think, the test was developed on mammals, on juvenile swine and mice. With some others, so there's some potential use there, but exposure is different, right? We're very much tailored to human health and children. So there are some pertinent differences. I think it would be a very stretch to go to other critters if you're looking at birds. Certainly, if you start looking at invertebrates, you're probably not justified. But if we're talking mammals, I think might be useful. So I think that's a solid maybe.
All right, excellent. We did have a question about USDA regulated soils and how they relate to lead and arsenic RBA assessments.
Can take that one. So the USDA regulation is really just for transport of soils across state lines to make sure invasive pest species such as fire ants don't transport from one state to the other. So it doesn't really have any influence on specifically the RBA or the IVBA analyses, just simply on the transport of soils. It's just something that you would want to have in place before you were to transfer those from one state to the other.
All right, excellent. And now, as I scan through what's left in that queue, it looks like the most popular question that several people have been asking about is practical implementation of this method, looking for laboratories that are certified to run the IVBA method. A number of participants have noted that they've been unable to find, or there are very limited labs that hold accreditation for the method. And they're wondering if EPA can help point them in the direction or help identify labs who are certified to run this method.
I can start with that one, Jean, and then get Matt to help chime in on that one. First of all, we have a number of regional laboratories that are set up and routinely run this method, including regions 4, 6, 7, 8, and 10. I don't think region 9 is running this method currently. And there are a number of commercial laboratories that may be able to run this. As far as the competency goes, there are a number of samples that are included in the IVBA extraction, such as blanks, duplicates for the soils, as well as matrix spikes and a NIST SRM that's included. So this would help to confirm competency. Matt, do you have other thoughts on the laboratories?
Yeah, I will. One would be we couldn't give a name or a list of laboratories. We have run this test with commercial laboratories as part of how the validation was done. One thing that came up with conversations with commercial labs in general is that when they get demand for this method, they will start offering the method. And I think they had just have not had much demand. This is a very, this is a very easy method for them to implement. Does not require a lot of expertise or new expertise anyways, and it also doesn't require too much equipment, at least not expensive equipment. So most of the labs we have talked to in the past have said we're just not getting demand, and we'll offer it when we get the demand. So we are hoping to see more provincial labs offering it as folks are start looking for it.
Okay.
Is there an accreditation specific to IVBA that's required from a policy perspective?
I don't believe so. I think we point to the SW846 methods. This is one of those methods, and if they're following that, I actually that might be a question for the program itself. I don't know what they require of their commercial labs.
One other question that I see popping up here in the queue, if there are other concerns about shipping the samples to other states for analysis, would there be any issue with that?
There is, again, that's something that you would want to apply for a USDA soil shipping permit. It can be obtained through the USDA on their website for soil shipping. They have two different applications, one specific to soil shipping across different state lines or even internationally, which can be done. The other one is if someone's going to run some sort of testing on those samples, such as plant test or that type of thing. Really, what the USDA is looking for again is to make sure that those soils are not released into the environment, that they are autoclaved to a certain temperature or disposed of in a proper manner so that the invasive pest species are not able to inhabit other areas of the country than where they are currently located. So if you were to go to the USDA website, I think we could probably post that at a later date, Jane. We could get that link, but that's the shipping.
Okay. And they had a follow-on clarification. Would the lab normally do all of this if they are the ones shipping the samples?
Someone needs to obtain that USDA shipping application and permit. It depends on how often you're shipping them. You may want to have one main contact within ORD. We have two of them that I know in two different locations because that's primarily where we're doing the research in Cincinnati and in North Carolina. So that's something that you would have to discuss with your laboratory.
All right, it is 2:20. I'm seeing thank yous and some positive feedback, so but no new questions, which is a good sign for all of our panelists. So I just wanted to make sure, Clay, any final thoughts that you wanted to leave the audience with as I wait to see if any other questions come in before I close us out today?
Nothing other than a second thank you for participating.
All right, wonderful. All right, I'm going to take over the screen here. And with that, also echo Clay's gratitude to all of the panelists who joined us from all over the US for today's session, sharing their time and expertise. And I want to thank all of the participants who joined us in today's session. We had nearly 100 of you join us for today's live broadcast, and we're really glad you were here. We hope that you found this to be a valuable use of your time. I'll remind everyone, please visit us at the Cleanup Information Network. That's at cluin.org. If you liked today's topic or you want to be alerted to other free online technical information sessions, new guidance, new websites related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup, visit us at Cluin. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, and I'll highlight sessions like today's. I will also remind you that there is a unique seminar homepage dedicated to today's session. The URL is shown in red on the slide. It's the same website we would have sent you to when registering. It's the same place you went to check in. It's the same place I sent in the reminder emails. Feel free to bookmark that website because, in addition to information about your speakers and panelists, we also have copies of the presentation materials already posted. And then, in this particular case, links to a whole slew of references on our topic. You can scroll up and down on that page to jump to the sections on the slides and related links, or use those little plus or minus icons to collapse or expand the various sections to jump right to the information you need. Today's website is available there, and it's going to be open from today forward, so you can feel free to bookmark it or pass it on to other colleagues. For those of you who are looking for certificates of participation based on today's session, you can receive one of those after you complete the feedback form for our session. That feedback form is linked on the seminar homepage. So if you go to that URL, you scroll down to the feedback form and fill it out, you will have a box at the bottom of the form that you can check, certifying you were here for the entire live delivery. And then once you submit your feedback form, as long as this box is checked, you'll then immediately have access to a certificate of participation that you can download or print out for your own records. If you don't check that box certifying you were here for the whole thing, we won't issue one of those certificates. Make sure you take that final step. If you happen to have multiple people join at your location or hosted my personal favorite, the viewing parties for our webinars, I'd kindly ask the person who registered, please be sure to take a minute to send this URL to everyone who joined you at your location, because each person can fill out that feedback form. Even if they didn't register on their own, they can still share feedback and get their own participation certificate as long as you can pass that URL on to them. Our session today was recorded. It will be available for on-demand playback, just as the others were in the series. And I will remind everybody, once we get all four of them up, I'll send a follow-up email that has direct links to each of the archives in this four-part series. As noted, there are important points of contact in email and websites that you can go to for additional information or questions on our topic today. As soon as the archived version for today's session is available, you'll automatically get an email from me. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying today's archive, you can still fill out a feedback form and get a certificate of participation based on your replay. So right about now, if you're watching the archive above my head in the upper right corner, there should be a button that will allow you to jump over to that feedback form. You can fill it out, checking the box saying you replayed the entire archive, and then we'll issue, again, one of those participation certificates once you submit your feedback. We'll also email a copy, but those sometimes get caught up in junk or spam filters, so I encourage you to download it right from that confirmation screen when you send the form in online. So again, give me about a week and I'll send out that follow-up email with the archive to part four. And then again, a separate email will list all four in the series so you can share that with colleagues. Again, a great big thank you to all of our speakers, all of our panelists, and all of you for joining us on today's live session. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.